I'm not exactly sure what I'm going to say to you today, but let me just start talking and see what happens. It looks like I have it all planned here, but we'll see whether I do or not. In this section called Introduction, let me first say that the casting off of Judaism and Christianity is determined by what we call the Jewish double. And this whole talk is going to be based on the fact that there is a time when, just like Pilate washed his hands of the whole matter, God washes his whole hands of the matter. And he says to Judaism, I've had it. You don't speak for me anymore. And he does the same thing 1845 years later. He says to Christianity, I've had it. You're cast off. You're fallen. Those are big events. Really big events. And I do want that to be stressed in this 45 minutes, if nothing else is. At that point, those two things become religious non-entities. Judaism could have just been Shintoism all of a sudden. Christianity could have just as well been Hinduism all of a sudden when these dates arrive. Let's talk about it. Now, these dates are determined by the prophecies we know as the Jewish double. I've listed them there. I will not read them. But Isaiah 40, Jeremiah 16, and Zechariah 9 all refer, in one instance, to the very day when these things happen. And what happens is, and I'm sure you've heard this in your studies, and you've read it in Scripture, Jesus would be a rock of offense and a stone of stumbling to both houses. Let those two words sink in. I'm going to more or less equate house with covenant. That's another subject, so I'm not going to elaborate on it. But he had a covenant with Israel. They stumbled over Jesus. Christianity, God had a covenant with. They stumbled over Jesus. And God in both cases said, this day, I've had it. Okay, now I'm going to read the three texts up right under the title because they at least will give you the dramatic moment. Matthew is not Revelation, last time I looked. Matthew 23:38. Behold. Don't underestimate that word just because it's all over the place. It's a very important word. In our study of Revelation, we just constantly realize that at that point, God says, stop, look, and listen. Something rather important is about to be said here. This is not your average keep on reading. Behold, your house is being left to you desolate, empty. Revelation 14:8. Another angel, a second one, followed, saying, fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great, she who has made all the nations drink of the wine of the passion of her immorality. We'll probably have to talk about the word Babylon later, but right now, and I'm really generalizing because I don't mean this, Babylon and Christianity are not similar, but in some senses they become that way. But notice, fallen, fallen. Why? She had drunken parties with the nations. That was part of Israel's problem. Problems are not really different between the two houses of Israel. Revelation 18, 2 and 4. He cried out with a mighty voice, saying, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great, and she has become a dwelling place of demons and a prison of every unclean thing and a prison of every unclean and hateful bird." And verse 4, I heard another voice from heaven saying, "Come out of her, my people, that you may not participate in her sins and that you may not receive of her plagues." That whole concept of separation is so strong. If you decided to remain with Judaism in 33 when Jesus said your house is left to you desolate, you made a mistake. If you didn't get out, you made a mistake. And it is just as powerful in 1878 when the Lord says of Babylon, "It's fallen." I don't know how adequately to communicate the importance of this. You know, you may know brethren who do say, "Well, there's not a lot of nice people there. Oh, that particular denomination is nicer and closer to the truth than the others." And hogwash! God says, "I've washed my hands of it. Don't go near it. Get out of it." Or as Jesus said, "Flee from Jerusalem." And I'm going to bring up this thought of Judaism, not Israel, but Judaism, just like Christianity, are gone. They are defunct religions. I know you claim to be part of Christianity, but it's in a different sense. This is the Christianity which God dealt with despite the fact that it was a mixture of tares and wheat. That ends in 1878. Okay, these are very scripturally sound dates, and we go beyond them and we add parallels, you know. Besides 1878, you get 1881. Some brethren go further than Daniel dares to go and go to 1914. Some have gone way beyond that. I'm not talking about parallels. I am talking about these two twin ages, the double. Forget parallels now. Just wipe them out of your head. 1845 years, Judaism is my voice. 1845 years, Christianity is my voice. Okay, when the casting off comes, what good immediately follows it? In AD 33, the establishment of a spirit-begotten nation happened. That's the good of what followed it. God rumpled it up, Judaism, and threw it in the trash can, and he established Christianity, a new spirit-begotten nation. It's 3.5 years after that harvest started. Second Advent, 1878. What happens that's good immediately after the casting off of Babylon or Christianity? In 1878, you have the re-establishment of Israel, the earthly Jerusalem, and you have the birth of a new unseen rulership, the sleeping saints. And this too is 3.5 years after the harvest begins. He throws Christianity away, and he says, "I'm working with Israel now." You know, 1878 is not an obscure date with Israel. That's the whole point of the end of the double. The double was disfavor. So what happens after disfavor? Favor. Yes. So what happens after he throws Christianity away? He says, now, whether you can see it or not, the voice of Israel is the earthly thing that is now begun. He is setting Israel up to be the visible part of the heavenly kingdom in 1878. Auspicious date. And at the same moment, because it's the same kingdom, he takes all of those from Christianity who have been faithful, and he exalts them in the first resurrection. The spiritual part of that same new kingdom. So just as when Judaism was thrown off, he started a spirit-begotten nation, when Christianity is thrown away, he starts the actual functioning with those who form the powers of the new kingdom, earth and heaven. Okay, why does he wait until 3.5 years after the reign begins? Let me look at Matthew 24:43 with you in the margin. And this is not the only text that does this. There's a couple others. But the marginal translation is correct. Be sure of this, that if the head of the house, that's Satan, had known at what time of night the thief was coming, that's 1874, he would have been on the alert and would not have allowed his house to be, margin, dug through. Jesus is the one entering. He's not like a thief who breaks the window, unlocks the lock, and goes in and takes your Rolex watch. That's not the point. This is not like that at all. If Satan had known at what time Jesus was coming, he would have been on the alert and would not have allowed his house. Very similar to house with God, the covenant arrangement. It is Satan's world. It's his house. And Jesus is not entering it to steal Satan's Rolex. Jesus is entering it like a horde of termites. This marginal translation is correct. Dug through. For 3.5 years, Jesus is nibbling on the rafters of Satan's order. I doubt Satan even knew it. But that's one reason he didn't raise the sleeping saints at that point, because the sleeping saints would have been in the earth's atmosphere with Jesus, and Satan would have said, 100,000 besides Jesus, and he would have taken erratic actions that would have slowed the plan down. So there is a reason for the 3.5 year delay. It's for the termites to work. Now, what bad is eliminated at each casting off date? Again, 3.5 years after a new age begins. But what's bad? That's eliminated. The virtual worthlessness of formerly favored arrangements. Worthlessness of former arrangements. Judaism, only reason it went beyond 33 to 36, based on the Daniel 70 week prophecy, is because God was dealing with the valuable parts, not with the part he's throwing away. The same thing happens at the second advent. The reason between 78 and 81 is because God's still dealing with the valuable parts of the old arrangement. But the arrangement itself is null and void and putrid. Abominable.
Mm.
Sister Suzanne defined that for me in one of our studies. Brother David, do you know what abominable means? I said, what? She means it stinks. I love that. Okay, so what's the point here? The bad is eliminated, and the worthlessness of the former favored arrangements means don't go there. I cannot stress it enough, brethren, because in our ecclesia sometimes we don't stress it enough. Stay clear of it. Stay clear of Judaism. Stay clear of Christianity. They stink. And God has nothing whatsoever to do with them, and they don't speak for Him. I don't care how many nice people are there. That's immaterial. Prophetically, it doesn't matter. Okay. Well, the fact is they are cast off, but each one remains irritatingly around. They aren't gone. I mean, it's taken 2,000 years. Judaism's still here. They haven't gotten the point yet. And certainly Christianity. In AD 33, Israel is no longer God's representative on earth. In 78, Christianity is no longer God's representative on earth. What a vital simplicity. You know, we could make a lot about these dates, but the vital simplicity is, you say to God, Christianity, and He says, who? You say to God, Judaism, He says, who? Now, the point of Christianity for 1845 years was for the selection of the bride. Now, I know the bride was not finished in 1878, but it was raised in 1878. What there was of it. She happens to be a big bride. But Christianity is not the religion of the Messianic age. Brother Edwinski's looking at me like, what? What? Christianity is not the religion of the Messianic age. Christianity was the religion for the development of the bride. The religion of the millennial age doesn't even have a name yet that I know of, but it's going to be that new covenant that is for the whole age being mediated. Won't be Judaism. Won't be Christianity. Now, let's get into some details, which I guess I haven't done yet. One thing has plagued a lot of brethren, still does, and that's the occasional statement by Brother Russell. In 1878, he took unto himself his great power and began his reign. I don't think that expresses it clearly. When we understand the points of these dates of 1878 with the Jewish double and with the proclamations about these dates, what happened at the first advent was not that Jesus became king of Israel in 33. It's that he presented or announced himself as king. In 1878, Jesus doesn't begin his reign. It's already begun. He's been undermining 3.5 years with his horde of termites. But in 1878, he announces his reign. You will notice Brother Russell does not in 1874 say, seventh trumpet, the Lord has returned and has started his reign. That doesn't happen in 1874. That happens about 1878. This is about the time Brother Russell calls the ministers together in Pittsburgh. Says, I want to tell you this secret. It's when the Lord announces his reign begun, not when he assumes his authority. (clears throat) 1878, that call, come out of her, begins. And it says, come out so that you won't be partaker of her plagues. So the announcement happens before the plagues. I mean, if this ceiling is falling down, there's no point in my announcing, maybe we ought to get out of the room. If I tell you 3.5 minutes before it happens, that's smart. Then you're not going to get the falling ceiling. So it does say, come out of her, because plagues are coming on her, future from that time. Daniel 9. Why do I have... Oh, never mind. Daniel 9, 24 is a text probably most of you have studied about the 70 weeks. And in 33, the Daniel 9 prophecy, 9:24, let me read it. 70 weeks have been decreed for your people, that's Israel, and your holy city, that's Jerusalem, to finish the transgression, to make an end of sin, to bring atonement for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up the vision and prophecy. I read all that fast because I'm not going to comment on it. And then he says, and to anoint the most holy. So this is what happens in 33 to 36, that 3.5 years, the remnant of the Jewish age become Christians. That period was designed for those coming out to receive something new that hadn't been previously available. Same thing happens at the Second Advent in 1878. When Babylon is fallen, is fallen. There are actually two remnants. Because the kingdom's in two parts, heavenly and earthly. So in 1878, we are going to have two things that happen for those what we can call the remnants. In the earthly sphere, the Jewish remnant will be gathered to be those whose skirts will be available for others to take hold of. You remember Zechariah 8:23, 10 men of all nations will take hold of the skirt of him that is a Jew. Well, 1878 is the start of the preparation so that can happen. As we mentioned earlier, there's more than the remnant, because Judaism intends to stick around whether anybody wants it or not. But it's the remnant that counts. Let me look with you at Matthew 9:20-22. This is just more of a curiosity than anything else, but it really appeals to me. And the Mark text that's given on your handout is virtually the same, but a longer version of it. Matthew 9:20-22. Behold, a woman who had been suffering from a hemorrhage for 12 years came up behind him and touched the fringe of his cloak. That's the hem of his garment. For she was saying to herself, if I only touch his garment, I shall get well. But Jesus, turning and seeing her, said, "Daughter, take courage, your faith has made you well." That was one woman. But it's exactly the same picture that we get with the Zechariah 8 text. 10 men of all nations will take hold of his skirt, and they will be made whole. That's what starts in 1878. The skirts are being prepared for the earthly part of the kingdom. It's a faith response that will do the healing. I know it's going to require perfect works, but it's a faith response that will do the healing. They won't be able to enter into the program that allows them to gain perfect works until they have enough faith to grab hold of that faithful remnant. That faithful remnant is one of the two remnants that come into existence starting in 1878. The other is heavenly. In the parable of wheat and tares, the church remnant starts going into the barn or the rulership position. Okay. Now, next page. I am fairly well convinced in my mind that the word Babylon in prophecy is a reference to the Roman church. I know we and Brother Russell use it to represent nominal Christianity in general. And there's something to that. I'm not denying it. But I think in prophecy, it is rather strictly the Roman church. Let me read Revelation 17:5 for you, just as one sample. I'll read 3 through 5. "He," that's Brother Russell, "carried me away in the spirit into a wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast full of blasphemous names, having 7 heads and 10 horns. And the woman," the Roman church, "was clothed in purple and scarlet and adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a gold cup full of abominations and of the unclean things of her immorality." That's not Christianity. That's the fake Christianity. That's the tares at best, and other things at worst. "And upon her forehead, a name was written, a mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth." Now, that's not speaking about Christianity. That is speaking about that portion of Christianity that for most of its history was the Roman church. And so I think in prophecy, Babylon, when you really want to get explicit and implicit, is Rome. Not Rome and denominational Christianity, just plain old Rome, because it is the part that represents everything that's wrong with Christianity. It represents the thing that made God upset with Christianity. Now, it says daughters. And I think they are daughters by reason of continued association. The mother of harlots. There's two kinds of harlotry in scripture prophecy. One is church and state. That's what we usually think of, and that's the Roman church, without question. Then there is the harlotry where you can't tell the difference, or you don't care to tell the difference, between the sacred and the profane. And I think this is the kind that's being talked about here for those who are daughters. In other words, those that have taken on the genetic characteristics of their mother are those who love to mix the sacred with the profane. It's not that they are other church states. It's that they can't get away from the fact that, yeah, I want a little pleasure on this side, and yeah, a little belief on this side. And that's what makes them daughters. And that's what makes them harlots. Not harlots in church-state sense, but harlots in mixing the flesh with the spirit sense. So Babylon becomes a symbol of the confused mixture of sacred and profane, and any part of Christianity that goes along with her, and her is Rome. Not necessarily in church state, but in mixing the pleasurable with the spiritual, become daughters. By the way, the only religious beasts mentioned in Revelation are in chapter 13, or in prophecy for that matter, as far as Christianity is concerned, are the two-horned beast and the ten-horned beast. Rome and Anglicanism, that's it. Protestantism is never called beasts. Just a curiosity, in case you happen to be studying the Philadelphia church. I don't know whether you've ever noticed it. It's the church that has no criticism. All the others have something said bad about them. Philadelphia has no criticism. It's the time of the rise of Protestantism. The Lord is so pleased with Protestantism. And all of a sudden, when 1878 comes along, he isn't going to say, I don't like you anymore. He obviously doesn't like that part of Protestantism that went astray because they become daughters. But the Lord does not criticize the growth of the Protestant church. It doesn't happen. I'm not saying that they aren't wheat and tares still mixed. They are. But the Lord was pleased that they would search for truth. If they felt locked in, they'd go and do a new denomination. And if that didn't satisfy them, they'd go and do another new denomination. There is no criticism of Protestantism in the Philadelphia church. Not one word. Babylon was a golden cup in the Lord's hand. This is where we have to keep this concept of the two houses of Israel. During the entire Jewish age, 1845 years, who was God's voice in the world? Israel. Was Israel good? No. Did you ever read the books about their kings? Every once in a while it says, now this king was good. What's the implication? All the rest of them were terrible. And the same thing happens with Christianity. We shouldn't expect that Christianity is going to be any better than its type, Israel. It's no better. But it is the Lord's golden cup during 1845 years. There is no other source of listening to the Lord. If you were not a part of Christianity, which is inseparably linked from Babylon, you could get the Lord's truth from nowhere else. You had to get it from there. No other source. Why do I have compared Romans 3? Let me find out. Romans 3, 2 and 3. What then? If some did not believe, their unbelief will not nullify the faithfulness of God, will it? Isn't that a wonderful verse? Babylon's a golden cup. If some of them didn't believe, that's not going to nullify the fact that they were the Lord's voice. May it never be. Rather let God be found true, though every man be found a liar, etc. Okay. Oh, all right, verse 2. First of all, they were entrusted with the oracles of God. The Bible, Old Testament, was in Judaism. It wasn't anywhere else. The Bible, Old plus New Testament, was in Christianity, including Babylon. It was nowhere else. It was the golden cup in the Lord's hand. We would have healed Babylon, Jeremiah 51. That's probably a reference to 1521, when Martin Luther was excommunicated and the Protestant Reformation began in full bloom. We would have healed Babylon, but she wouldn't be healed. Unfortunately, her influence, she recovered from the blow that killed that particular head of the dragon, and she went on doing the same old stuff, and unfortunately some of her daughters did it also. Nevertheless, ever since this healing starts in 1521, which I'm suggesting is a date, you may have a better one. Ever since that healing started, something was happening. Denomination A came along and threw away that error. Denomination B came along and threw away that error. Well, they went all the way through the alphabet, at least. By the time you get to 1846, the sanctuary was cleansed. Every error had been exposed. This is before Brother Russell. But it was the remnant, not the whole, that was cleansed. Okay. At 33 and at 1878 points in time, the sign goes up, don't go there anymore. Both houses had been removed as the Lord's representatives on earth. Christendom and Judaism do not exist anymore as the Lord's beacons on the planet. I don't care how much the Pope paints his face. I don't care how much so-and-so reverend on the TV tells you how wonderful you are. It's all trash, and the Lord doesn't listen to it, and it's not his voice. But they do exist in actuality, and they need to be eliminated. That's the part of prophecy we have yet to watch. Both will be eliminated by Ezekiel 38 and 39. In Judaism, the Lord will purge out the rebels. Nobody will be hanging on to Judaism anymore. In Ezekiel 38 and 39, Christianity will be destroyed. The grapes will have been thrown into the wine vat, the last feature of the harvest, etc. The wine vat will be trodden outside the city of Babylon. It'll be trodden in Israel, in Ezekiel 38 and 39. When you read in Revelation 19, when this angel says, come to the feast and eat all these commanders, etc., etc., it's a quote from Ezekiel 39. And it's about the very final trouble that destroys Christianity in Revelation 19. But in Ezekiel 39, it's about the trouble on Israel from which it is delivered. All these events are simultaneous. The great time of trouble, such as never was since there was a nation, is Ezekiel 38 and 39. It's the winter time. Both the lights, both were lights among the nations during their 1845-year parallels. 1878 marks the beginning of the binding of tares, Matthew 13:30. The burning of tares awaits Ezekiel 38 and 39. Laodicean ecclesias are tare-free. That's quite a claim, isn't it? But there's a reason for that. Most of you are not old enough, like I am, to have spoken to brethren who knew Brother Russell. I mean, I cannot count on hands and toes the number of brethren that knew Brother Russell, were in his presence, and I've talked to those brethren. To a person, they said, when Brother Russell met you the first time, just about the first question he asked is, are you consecrated? And this is why there are no tares in Laodicean ecclesias, because for the first time since Ephesus, probably, we distinguish between the consecrated and the unconsecrated. Tares are unconsecrated who say, I'm the Lord's, I'm going to heaven. Well, that's a tare viewpoint, because they're not consecrated. In our ecclesias, everybody in them isn't consecrated, but they also don't claim to be going to heaven. So they're not tares. They're not claiming to be part of the body of Christ. There are no tares in Laodicean ecclesias. Consider 1878 as the New Age replacement for the Babylonian era. Babylon means mixture and confusion. 1878 was the replacement for mixture and confusion. 1874 to 1878 is the lay hold period of Revelation 20. By the way, when's my time up?
In 1 minute.
In 1 minute. Well, I won't go into that then. Okay. And I'm not going to do that in a minute, so I won't even try. 1878 is the placement of earthly Israel for its peaceable position, as well as the placement of heavenly Israel for its peaceable position. Neither one of them gets a peaceable position in 1878. They're still both waiting for the peace, but it is their placement. Part of them in heaven, part of them in Israel, for what they are going to do and be. Both placements must await the peace after the transitional troubles are finished. Okay, I probably would have liked to have said more, but I'm not a 45-minute kind of guy. Lord bless you richly.